Hello and welcome to the Cracking Cybersecurity Podcast. I'm Anna, editor at TICE, the leading cybersecurity site for high-level security experts. This week I talk with TICE podcast friend Joe Carson, chief security scientist at Thycotic, who takes us through the mind of a hacker. What reconnaissance does a hacker conduct before an attack? What are the vulnerabilities they're looking for? When are hackers most likely to strike? Joe shares his thoughts on these questions, as well as addressing the risks of introducing IoT for ease of use, but sacrificing security, and how you can prevent and reduce the risk of abuse to your critical information assets. Don't forget, I'll be back at the end of the podcast with a cyber tip of the week. But first, here is my interview with Joe, who begins by taking us through the mind of a hacker.
So, if you think about when you get into the mind of a hacker, they will first of all gather that digital footprint. And the digital footprint will give them a very good understanding of the organization. When you think about digital footprint, however, it means everything about that organization. Everything from blueprints to their offices, to the hierarchy in the organization, to everyone's both their company telephone numbers, their personal telephone numbers, to what car they drive, to how they get to work, the office location, to their family members, to what sports activities they do or what hobbies they may have. You gather everything you possibly can. In any type of ethical hack or penetration test that I've been involved, that 90% of the time, of the entire time that you do, 90% of it's actually spent on doing research. So one thing, if you think about an attacker or cyber criminal, they spend a lot of time researching their targets. And all things is public available information before. They don't want to alarm anything. They don't want to trigger an alert or, you know, increase the defenses of the company that they're targeting. They want to make sure that they can gather as much information so that they can simply bypass the security controls. Because you can gather a really good understanding about a company's defenses by looking at videos and watching and seeing if you get a screenshot of someone's laptop that's on the web. You can automatically see from the actually taskbar icons what software they're using. And this is all of that preparation, all of that readiness allows you to basically, the next stage is literally, if you do a proper, you know, reconnaissance, the next stage only takes 24 to 48 hours to do it successfully.
So what words come to mind when you think of how a hacker works?
I think one of the misconceptions is that, let's say, it's not the typical people that's in hoodies in their parents' basements. That's an incorrect, and that's something that the media has over portrayed. So people think automatically of the hoodies, or they think of the anonymous masks. That's what people relate to when they think about hacking. However, in reality, it's basically, you know, regular people doing 9-to-5 jobs that maybe don't have much of a social life in the evening. They will spend their time doing hobbies and activities, which is very technical oriented. Now, the other misconception is that when you go to a lot of these events and conferences and you go to trainings, most of the time they train people on things like Kali Linux. So Kali is like a hacker toolbox that gives you a lot of tools for cracking passwords or creating fake websites or doing vulnerability assessments or looking for exploits in systems. So it gives you a lot of different tools. However, in the real world in the field, the best hackers don't use those tools. Those tools are almost like for training or for learning the techniques. When you actually get into a company's environment, the last thing you want to do is introduce anything that's going to get you detected. The one thing that most criminals or cyber criminals or hackers don't want to be is found. They don't want to be detected. And the way that they get around that is by using the company's own tools that they have, that living off the land, as they call it, is that if I find that they're using System Center for systems management, then you will have someone who's knowledgeable in depth about System Center, and you'll use that tool in order to move around the network, to discover the systems, to look for unpatched systems, to gather inventory. You use the own tools that the organizations have deployed themselves to be able to move around and do what you want, you know, what your task or your goal is to obtain.
So what are the vulnerabilities that hackers find to exploit?
Most of the vulnerabilities is, there's two types of vulnerabilities. Most of the vulnerabilities that we look through is human-based, is failure in process. You look for humans who are easily abused in regards to giving credentials. So one of the things we look is from a vulnerability perspective is you've got one is technical and the other one you've got human. So the human is the fastest and the cheapest way to get access to the system. So if I can, you know, send somebody, for example, one method I did, this is about almost 2 years ago now, is that we did a phishing campaign against a government agency. And the phishing campaign, what we did was we sent them speeding tickets. So 100 people in the agency got speeding tickets on a Friday afternoon at 5:30 p.m. And the reason why is speeding tickets, it's a fear of doing something illegal. You're afraid of actually breaking the law. People don't want to break the law. So you're showing them that they may have broken the law. And then the next thing is people don't want to be impacted financially, which means that the actually speeding tickets comes with a financial fine. If you don't pay it, you have a fine. You go to court. And then the next stage is you also want the time element. You want people's sense of urgency. They must do things immediately. And then the speeding ticket, it doubled in 48 hours, 24 hours, and then tripled in 48 hours if you didn't click on the link. So there's a sense of urgency. People need to do something now. You want to do and get them to do what you want them to do immediately. And all the information in that email was correct. It was all accurate, except the one link. We spoofed the speeding, domain. We got the template easily accessible on the internet. We basically modified the template. We got all the contact information. We knew what people's cars they were driving, license plates, addresses, all contained in that phishing campaign. So everything was accurate. Even if they called a telephone number, it was in the bottom. It would actually say, you know, our office hours are 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. And that's why you chose 5:30 p.m. on a Friday when they're closed. They can't validate the ticket. So this is where you really play the urgency is you look at when people's the most vulnerable, their most highest risk. Well, first thing when they come in the morning, when they're going at their lunch break, when they're trying to get away on a Friday afternoon. That's when you see cyber criminals or even hackers, you know, you're just paid to do ethical hacking. That's when they abuse and use the time sensitivity. When's the best time to target someone? So that's kind of an easy way to get people's access to credentials, to get people to install software that could take over their systems, that could give you access and backdoors into the organization's network. That's the primary method. It's the cheapest method today, and it's the quickest method. If you get an organization where it's mostly infrastructure and there's less people, or the people is a bit more technical aware, then of course you look for system vulnerabilities. You look for exploits. You look for unpatched systems. And there's many of those around. If you even go back to just recently in September, there was a zero day that was in Microsoft Windows task scheduler that could allow you to take a standard user and elevate it to a privilege account. So, and many people who have one foot in the door, who are just waiting for those moments, will take advantage of it. So there's two ways, yes. You know, looking for the human vulnerabilities and looking for the technical vulnerabilities. But the cheapest method today is, of course, the human.
You mentioned the time of day when somebody might be more vulnerable. Are there other times of maybe the year or the week that are quite sensitive?
There's always periods of the year, seasons. You know, you're coming up to the Christmas holidays. So you've got the Christmas period coming soon. You'll have a lot of the sales coming on, shops. You'll have different events, sporting events. You'll have tax seasons, election seasons. Every single thing that has some type of major event happening or seasonal event or holidays, you know, in the U.S., it'll be Thanksgiving. Those will all be taken advantage of by cyber criminals in order to send something that will eventually get in front of you and take advantage of that, time-sensitive period that people want to get things done quickly. And they'll also take advantage of the time of day and the time of week. And they'll also take advantage of common websites that people go to. So the most popular website, for example, is sending Christmas cards. People will probably spoof the domain. And then all of a sudden, you're not going to a domain and sending, putting, you know, people's home addresses into those sites, logging in, reusing old passwords that are used in other sites, and then eventually giving criminals access to your personal information and giving it to them. So absolutely time sensitivity and events are taken advantage of. The worst cases are more when it's disastrous events where people are trying to be charitable. Cyber criminals do take advantage of that significantly.
They often say that we should study our enemy. It's one of the greatest rules of warfare. But everything you're saying seems to make me think that we should be studying ourselves more, like our own vulnerabilities when we're more sensitive, or our systems, as you say, because if the hacker is studying our systems, how can we do that better?
So this is some of the points, and this is where I get into a lot of cyber awareness and education. This is what my purpose of my workshops are, that I will go to organizations and I will give them my mind of how I look at the organizations from a hacking point, from a cyber criminal. I can't put, you know, that cyber criminal hat on and think about, well, if I was going to gain access to that organization, what would be my path? So what I try to do is educate companies into that mindset. If you understand how criminals look at you and how they see you and how they research that information, it gives organizations and even people the actual knowledge about what they need to be looking at themselves and what information they need to be aware of, and helps you put in the right alarms and right alerts and also the right protection to make it more difficult. So this is absolutely, we need to have a better understanding of what the techniques are used by criminals, and at the same time, look at ourselves from that same view and make sure we take the immediate steps to make that more difficult. And unfortunately, in today's world, is that you only need to be more secure than your neighbor. In my case, you know, when I park my car, I park it next to a nicer car that has less security, in the hope that, you know, if somebody ever steals or is interested in stealing a car, they'll choose the nicer car with less security. So that's always the methodology that I've taken, at least in this path, is that we only need to be more secure than the neighbor. But at the same time, we need to educate the neighbor that they also need to improve their security. Because at the end of the day, no matter what organization or what we do in our social or life, is that we're only as secure as the people around us. So the more people around us are more secure, the more secure you become. Because we're as weak as our contact list, as the people that we're networked to in, you know, social media. If one of those friends becomes vulnerable, then we become vulnerable, because they could send us a message, and we, trusting human nature, will click in that message or click in that link that they send us. So we need to make sure that we actually spread awareness and get it more secure people around us, and that ultimately will make you more secure.
What have you learned about human behavior and psychology after all of these years and working in your field?
Well, there's a common saying that being from Belfast is that it makes people from Belfast or from Northern Ireland in general, we make very good cybersecurity professionals. And I was really, and I said to a friend of mine, why do you say that? I said, because you don't trust anybody. And that's...
They say the same about Israel, actually, don't they?
They do. That's exactly the same. Is that if you're more suspicious and you question everything, then it kind of makes you much more high alert. You're much more sensitive to your surroundings. And from a physical world, you know, it's the same in a digital space. If you take what you do in a digital world, when you're crossing the road or, you know, taking the train, or you're going through, you know, was it from home to work, you take certain steps and you kind of are more aware of what's around you. And you need to take the same cautious and same suspicion in the digital world as well. So absolutely, that we need to be more aware. We need to make sure that we are more kind of cautious into what we're clicking, when we're receiving things, about choosing passwords and the security controls. If you think about, you know, when you're going to lock your door, you're not going to put a piece of tape to try and make sure that criminals, you know, you're going to put a tape in your door that will stop people from getting in. That's not going to happen. And that's what we're doing today when we actually choose poor or weak passwords. When you choose a lock on your front door, you're going to choose something that's really going to keep it shut and keep the people who shouldn't be getting through it out, and only those who have access getting in. And we need to treat our security controls in the digital world the same way we treat our front doors in our homes.
Do you think we need to be so connected?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, this was a thing that I've always been asked in the past, and it's always been a debate into, is the digitalization embracing connectivity going to be our own downfall? You know, artificial intelligence, machine learning, all of those things is coming in the future, or even coming today. That I've always looked at, we need to treat it with responsibility. That's the most important thing, is that we need to understand what we're doing. We need to respect it, and we need to embrace it. So absolutely, connectivity and what we're doing in the future will only make us better. However, we must respect it and must treat it with responsibility and make sure that we understand its limitations and the risks involved.
But do you really think our kettle should be connected to our toothbrush and our energy system and our, you know, our heaters? And
I think we should be connected to information. I don't think necessarily that my toaster is going to benefit my life by being connected to the internet. Even if, you know, being a very high-tech person myself, you'd be quite surprised at how low-tech my home is. So, because while I like to be in the forefront and I like to be connected, yes, I don't see the need to have a toaster or a kettle connected to the internet. I think sometimes we go way beyond about what the life technology benefits are, and we should be really focusing on things that benefit our health, benefit the knowledge and education, make our lives much simpler in regards to, you know, how we do things on a daily basis. Those are the things that I think is most important versus having my kettle tell me when the water is a certain temperature. I don't think that's going to make a difference in my life.
We've had the recent budget. Philip Hammond has decided to give $1 billion to UK defence. Part of that is developing cyber capabilities. If you were his advisor, maybe you are, who knows, but if you were to advise him, where would you say that he has to invest the majority of the money?
So my advice would be is if, I mean, I've seen the reports and I looked at the news and I thought that this is just a small drop in the budget right now and it's not going to make a major impact.
You think there should be more?
Absolutely. The budget should be higher for cyber capabilities and cyber readiness. And I would say that no matter what you're putting down on technology, you should actually put in equally the investment in educating people. We need to make sure that not just the technology we have available to us, but we also need to make sure the people who's making decisions on it are educated in the right way as well and with the right information. So I think that that budget probably should be 5-10 times what it actually is, and specifically for cyber. Because today was an interesting article that I read recently that only a few countries around the world have access to nuclear weapons. But every country in the world has the possibility of having access to cyber weapons. And this is, you know, we've seen it in recent times is that, yes, while nuclear is a threat to land war, you know, it doesn't stop and prevent countries from doing cyber attacks. So nuclear does not prevent it. So we have to make sure that we get into one is better cyber defensive capabilities, but also using cyber offensive capabilities as a deterrence as well. However, it still should be done responsibly and should be done with absolute attribution at the same time. So I think that that budget, it's a reactive approach just to satisfy probably a political or PR basis. And I think that it should be at least, you know, 5-10 times more than what is allocated today.
Well, hopefully Philip is listening now. So what is the single takeaway or takeaways that you have for people about securing their devices and themselves?
So one of the things is about securing the devices is that one thing that I have a practice myself is that if you're not using it, turn it off. That's probably one of the best things I can recommend to people. If you're using a voice activated speaker at home, if you're not using it at nighttime or it doesn't need to be on, power it off. Don't put it in standby. Actually power it off. If it's powered off, there's less chances of it being hacked. So when you're not using devices, mobile phones, TVs, cameras, anything at home that doesn't need to be on when you're not using it, power it off, not standby mode. The other thing is make sure you're aware of when you're actually buying the devices, what security capabilities they have. Even when you're not just about technology, but also when you're doing internet services, get a better understanding about what security features they come with. And that should be something in the foreground. Many companies actually hide it away because they're afraid that people will see it and think it's too complicated. But we have to be better understanding about what capabilities it does have and be better educated in that area.
What are the minimum requirements that you'd look for?
Well, some of the minimum requirements that I look for is definitely multi-factor authentication. If I'm looking for an internet service or even a home device today, I want to have the ability to make sure that not a password isn't the only thing protecting that device, and that I have the capabilities of changing the password, and I have the capabilities of creating new accounts, and I have the capabilities of adding multi-factor authentication. Those, for me, are the three basic things that I must have the ability to do. And if I can do those, then I have a more higher confidence when I turn them on and enable them that I can stop bad people from getting access to them.
A big thanks to Joe. And now, time for our cyber tip of the week. Never reply to spam mails. It just encourages them. I know it's tempting, but just don't. Thank you for listening. Do tweet us your questions and comments on Twitter to @Tice. For now, it's bye from us. Join us next week for more Cyber Insight.